uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another live edition of the Global Reality right here on the Global Reality Radio Network with me, your host, Josh Reeves. Thanks for being with us here tonight. It is another late night Moonbat edition of the broadcast, Tuesday edition of the show, May 15th into Wednesday, May 16th, 2012. And it was another one of those days, and there almost wasn't a show yet again. Just an absolute lack of material. There's something's a brewing. I'm just going to put it to you like that. I'm not going to get up here and do 2 hours of speculation on, you know, FEMA camps and martial law and, you know, all this horseshit. But, you just kind of get a sense for things. I've been researching this stuff as long as I have. You know, there's something is amiss. And there I would definitely... I just say there's a good chance that, I don't know, something's going to, I don't know, man. I hate to even say stuff like this sometimes because, you know, people think you're a fear monger and all that, but I don't know. John Doe in the chat room, I think you said it best earlier. Yeah. Stay as far, hell far away from Chicago as possible. As hella far away from Chicago as possible. That would be my suggestion to each and every one of you out there. Yeah, just stay as far away from Chicago as possible. The NATO summit and all that stuff's coming up this weekend, and the moon is aligning in a way that. That these guys enjoy. You know what I mean? So we've got this Ring of Fire coming up this weekend. I'll get into some stories here in a bit, but I'll get more into it. But there's a lot of attention being paid to this eclipse this weekend. And several years ago, back in 2008, There was all this talk about shooting down this errant satellite. You might remember this. They said it was going to crash. And they said it was going to crash in Texas first. And then they said, we may shoot it down. And I said, you watch, they're going to shoot it down. They're going to shoot it down this Thursday or next Thursday, whenever it was, because there's an eclipse going on, all this stuff. And, you know, I'll be damned if they didn't do that. They love doing stuff during eclipses. I mean, it's something that goes way, 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 way back in time for these people. I've been talking about, you know, the process of making this new film and how much I've been learning. I just can't overstate that. In ways that you wouldn't even think. You know what I mean? Like, giving me a better understanding of even the whole, you know, New World Order, whatever you want to call it, the whole power structure thing itself, coming into this information and researching it. But I don't know, man. Something's in the air. I just get that feeling. I think there's going to be some kind of big event, meaningful event very soon. I don't know what that means or what that, how that can be defined. You know, I'm not going to speculate, but the news, I'm just judging that strictly on the news cycle right now. They're generally, you know, right now there's a dip in the news cycle and they're looking for things to cover because people don't really give a rat's ass about the elections and all this stuff. They just participate in it because it gives them the illusion of freedom. But, I don't know, Olympics are coming up soon too, right? We're getting to that time of year now. It's been kind of easy riding this whole year, but I think we're gonna start getting into some bumpy territory real soon. My website where this broadcast originates from is theglobalreality.com. That's www.theglobalreality.com. Up there, you'll find all things pertaining to my work, from all my documentary films, including the many films that I've made. You can also buy all those films on DVD. That's another way to support our work if you're new to listening. We also have The Secret Right Volume 2, my newest film. DVD and Blu-ray still for sale up there. So we have that. Archive shows, video clips, audio clips, books that I've read that people have been nice enough to cut down into condensed audiobook format. Those are all posted up there. All kinds of stuff, including the chipping banners to support our work and our film budget that's going on right now. Our goal, chipping banner goal this week is $300 so we can pay the stream bill. So act accordingly. Help us out there if you can. TheGlobalReality.com. Yes, I just happened to take a look at the chat room there for a minute. In our new, nice, secure chat room. It's been very fun since we've had this. Yeah, the stream is absolutely fine. No problems. In fact, I had talked about this hard drive issue that I had. I think seems to be doing okay now. I removed 34 viruses and switched out the port, the USB port that the hard drive was plugged into last night. And it's been running like a top ever since, so we'll go, and we got our new tube preamp in today. Thanks to Michael for buying that off of our wish list, our Amazon wish list, which is also at my website, theglobalreality.com. And in the past, when we needed new things for the work that we're doing here, whether it be computers or cameras or whatever else, we've had music stuff, because I have to, you know, I do all the music for my film, so that's part of the budget sometimes. You know, I have to buy new synthesizers. Well, they're actually old synthesizers, but you know, you had to factor that in, because I'll do all the music and stuff myself. But we, in lieu of doing fundraisers and stuff that we've done in the past, usually we've had fundraisers to raise money for buying equipment and whatnot. But now we're just been putting it, lately we've been putting this stuff up on the Amazon gift list. So that's a way that you can support our work. And that helps us get stuff that we need for the films. I've got stuff like a projector up there, which I'd love to be able to get, so I can start doing some, like, you know, screenings. Cause I'd love to be able to do like a little tour sometime. I'd love to, you know, have enough funds, and it wouldn't cost that all that much, you know, if you knew you were going to have people there to see you. But, you know, I thought about maybe when this current film was done, after it's all done, you know, doing like a small tour and going around different cities and showing the film and, you know, having signings and all that, and selling DVDs. I thought that might be a kind of a cool thing to do. We could probably also get to some different locations to get, you know, more footage for more films, you know. So maybe that'll be something we can do in the future. But yeah, we got the tube preamp rolling back here. Got my balls back. Oh, yeah. Oh, gotta have the tube preamp. Just sounds weak without it, you know. I've just gotten used to it. My listeners have gotten used to it, because I've always used a tube preamp from the very first show I've ever done until recently. And after that, the last one went out and finally died after I had replaced the tubes in it. Our sound just never really recovered after that. But now it seems to be sounding better. We just really need the next thing we need that's on our wish list for the studio is the well, actually, we only have three things left for the studio that we need on our wish list: the mic boom arm, and the mixing board. That's it. We'll have everything that we need for upgrade for our studio. And I'll tell you what, if I get I've got over 5 years out of the studio stuff that I have. So if I think if I get at least another 5 years out of this new stuff that we get, that's doing pretty good. Don't you think that's a pretty good money ratio there? You get 5 years out, especially using it. You know, I mean, this stuff gets used virtually every day. So I probably need to get, you know, some backup computers and stuff at some point as well. Some of these are getting on up there. I got the Mac, though, for making films, so that'll be good for at least another, oh, probably at least another 5 years. Maybe less, who knows? Technology's exponentiating so fast, it's hard to say, isn't it? The city of Rockwall voted in their citywide bond election on Saturday. And Proposition 4 on that bond vote was a $5 million project to excavate and create a park, Heritage Park, to excavate a section of the rock wall and build a park around it. I got to tell you, I'm having real problems. I flip-flopped on that, on whether or not I thought this was a good idea or not, at first. First, I heard about it. My initial reaction was that's not part of the wall, actual wall. And then I went back and looked at it and said, oh, maybe it is. You know, I don't really know. But then tonight I was doing some more research on that. And I can't get my map and my Google Earth with all the updated stuff. I can't get my maps to line up to that spot. It's close. We're talking within probably, you know, quarter of a mile at the absolute maximum, at the absolute most, quarter of a mile, maybe not even that, maybe a few hundred feet. This area where I've driven by it 100 times, and I've looked over there, and I've thought for years, you know, there's something back there. It looks like something out of a secret garden or something, you know? And it's funny, because that's what that guy said in that. And that's what it does kind of look like from the road. But I guess apparently that area, that property is for sale. But, I'm having trouble getting it to line up exactly on my spot. But, I mean, everybody says there's a big piece of it there and that it used to be exposed and they covered it up. And there's a gate and a thing there. But my thing is, you know, whether it definitely is something there. Maybe something that came later than the actual wall, but either way, the voters of the city of Rockwall unanimously voted on Saturday and by a whopping margin, 64.02% to 35.98% with 3,516 total votes for against. So, yeah, the Rockwall project in Rockwall, the city of Rockwall, has officially gotten the axe. Now, that, you know what that tells me? Now, I was looking at the bond, and I was looking at the proposal. And the $5 million that they want encompasses the entire amount to not only excavate the wall, but build this massive park, of which I will post a picture in the chat room. Well, there's a link to it. But you can click that link there in the chat room. That's the park they want to build. And they did this over a Google Map overlay, so I was very easily able to tell right exactly where this is at. I know exactly where it's at. It's not far from the old Rockwall Courthouse, very close to the lake, right before you get to the old 66 Bridge, right very near where the guy cracked that slate roof with his bulldozer, and it went down in there, and they wouldn't let him recover it. So the $5 million that they were like a 30% tax hike or something. I don't remember what it was. But anyway, voters voted absolutely no for this. So it's dead in the water, not going to happen. If you look at this map, it's got this proposed park. They're going to spend $5 million to build. It's got a nature trail. It's even got a place called The Grove. Isn't that interesting? Parking lot, the meadow, and then historic wall overlook in a place called Discovery Point next to it. And like, and I guess that's a little small area there where they'll have part of the wall excavated with the walk overlay. So I think, you know, most of this, that money was going to go towards building this park itself, not really towards excavating the wall well, I mean, think about it. Most of the money is going to be going towards building this park. But they were, that also included the money to buy the land. If they were going to buy that land, that means that land is for sale. And that also means that, you know, it's, I mean, $5 million, honestly, folks, $5 million in the grand scope of things is not a lot of money. It's really not. And what's interesting is how rich of a county Rockwall is. Was bid number one for the longest. It's been currently replaced, went down to number two. But those fuckers there got money. There's no reason why, I mean, any one of those, there's a lot of people in live in Rockwall that could pay this out of their own pocket in 2 seconds. I mean, with that overwhelming of a margin, 62%, and with majority of people going and voting for this being, you know, the people that pay a lot of taxes for living there, absolutely, positively did not want this to happen. But, boy, I tell you what, I don't have the money, but I know where this is at. I had some people a couple years ago said that they wanted to put up a couple of hundred grand, maybe even a million to do this. But I hadn't heard back from them. But, you know, I don't know. I don't know how much it would cost to buy that piece of property. But, man, I tell you what, wouldn't that be something? If I had the money, I would do it. I mean, if I had $5 million, if I won the lottery or something, fuck yeah. Or if some, you know, what we need, that's the reason I'm making this Volume 1 the way I am, is because this is why, I mean, I'm not playing with you. I'm going for the gusto with this. I'm going to put this out there, and I'm going to encourage people that have bucks to come forward to do this. And I think people like Dan Aykroyd, who, you know, funds digs for Crystal Skulls through making this vodka, I mean, people like him and probably others out there, should be no reason why one of those people wouldn't jump all over this. But it would be fantastic to get, you know, some private people in on this, you know, to buy that out from underneath the city, dude, and, you know, you could make your own park out of it, charge admission. Well, that's what the people who used to own it did. They charged a quarter. They had a part of the wall excavated there. They built an arched a walkway and a walk down to it and everything, and people paid a quarter. They came in and paid to see the wall. My idea is, fuck the city of Rockwall, and they're, you know, doing this on their own. $5 million, not a lot of money at all. A private investor needs to come in with $5 million, invest in this, build themselves to have an excavation, and then start yourself a rock wall park. Come see the rock wall. I mean, you know, if it's legit, you've got a big part of the wall there. I mean, they're going to make a park out of this. Well, fuck that. You make yourself a admission. $10. $10 admission. Come in and see the wall. Dude, you'd make money hand over fist. you'd have your $5 million, you'd have your $5 million back first couple of years, at least. And not only that, but you'd get the you'd have the ability to be able to, within your park that you owned, tell people the truth. You know what I mean? That would be, to me, the biggest thing. That'd be what, that'd be where all your money would be going to right there, would be going to, because you can't buy that for any amount of money. If you can buy it for $5,000, you're getting out cheap. I mean, sorry, $5 million. If you, I mean, $5,000, $5 million, what's the difference? Because, you know, you do your own excavation and your own digging on your own property that you bought and then create your own park out of that, and you find things that, because that was what worried me the most about the city doing this, and really why I wanted to see this fail. Be, and if it didn't fail and it did get approved, I was going to go to the city of Rockwall and ask them for permission to film the process. Because I think that anything done by official, official people concerning this, we have to look at very suspectly. I mean, we got centuries of cover-up going on here, folks, on all fronts. And this is a major, massive opportunity to be able to bring to light a huge chunk of something that really brings up questions about everything. That's what's so powerful about the enigma of the rock wall, is that it brings to light all these questions about not just that wall and just not, you know, ancient people or whatever. How the fuck were there people here 55 million years ago or whatever? But it brings up questions about everything. But I'm just still hoping that we've got a possible connection, I hear. Somebody who might have a location where we might be able to do a dig at. I still wait to hear back on that. I've got another spot located. I've actually got three spots. Well, four, counting the one that I haven't heard back from. But I've got three other ones besides that I've scoped. But I don't know what the possibility of being able to get a dig going on either side is. One is it's like a bird lease, like a bird hunting lease. You know, you go and pay, and they have signs up there. And my buddy, who actually is, you know, a hunter and has hunted birds in some of the past, I was thinking about trying to get him. You know, me and him were saying, well, let's go out there and tell him we wanted to go do a day of bird hunting. How much could it be? You know, $50 each or whatever. You know, let's go dress in our camo and get up real early and, you know, pay our $50 and go out there to go bird hunting, and let's go out there and fucking, because I've scoped the whole property on Google Images. This guy's got rock wall stuff all over it. They built a road right through it and split it in the middle of his property, and right on one side of the property is part of the rock wall. On the other side, there's a huge chunk of it, and they threw a bunch of road working construction stuff on top of it, gravel, to make it look like it was just, you know, some construction thing. But you get out and look at it, you can see it. It's the top of the wall. It's exposed. It's right there. Another spot I found is in an open lot with a tree in it right next to a subdivision. No indication of who owns it, no signage, nothing. It's just sitting there. And it's sitting on a big corner. It's sitting on the northwestern corner of the wall. Where was the other one? There were several others, but, I mean, you know, the problem here is getting permission to do it. But I'm not going to give up on this, and regardless of what happens, I just, like I said last night, I just feel it. This is going to happen. By hook or by crook, whether somebody comes forward and we buy a piece of property to do this. I mean, shit, when it's done, sell it, put it back on the market, whatever. But, you know, or we get permission from somebody, I don't know. But we're gonna go forward with this. But that area on that bird lease, bird hunting property where they where part of the rock wall is, there is right across from it. It's a gigantic house. And I've seen this house my whole life, going by it, going on road trips and stuff. I used to live not far from there, from Rockwall. And there's you can tell, and now that I've looked at it several times since then, you can tell that it's totally built on a mound, a giant mound. And that's another thing I'm going to be showing in the film, is I'm going to be showing downtown areas and showing why I believe that the downtown area very close to where this park was going to be built at was at one time full of mounds, and that they built the town right on top of it. It's happened in every other city and tons of other major cities all over the place, all over the place. Texas, the whole United States, everywhere. I know we got some listeners in Philadelphia, because I've heard from some of you guys. I don't know if any of you guys who live in Philadelphia or Pennsylvania at all, or anybody out there at all knows this, but it's a fact. If you go to downtown Pennsylvania, where Pittsburgh, and there's the art museum, and where the art museum is built, that's that whole area used to be mounds, and they just clobbered them all down. St. Louis, there used to be tons. There's only like one left in St. Louis, and it's in some old man's yard. But there at one time was over 200,000 of these mounds, and today there's only a handful of them left. Let's see what we have. I have some emails here. This is from Randall. He says, I just stumbled onto you via an interview you did with Red Ice. I've been downloading your MP3 radio programs to get a feel for your work, as well as watching your documentaries. Man, you're blowing my mind. You're welcome. I know you're skeptical of 9/11 truth shit, and you should be. Well, I used to be in it, man. I was in it before it was even a movement. I mean, I started. You do understand. I started the first 9/11 group in Dallas. I was the head of that. It still exists with the name that I came up with, North Texans for 9/11 Truth. I started that group. I didn't technically start it. It was started before I joined it, and I joined another group, and they didn't really have any direction. They didn't have that many people. And then I started going to their meetups. It was through meetup.com, and I started going to their meetups and, started giving them ideas and direction and info. And, we did a lot of work. I mean, I was responsible for passing out literally hundreds of thousands of movies. Unfortunately, a lot of those were Alex Jones movies, and I feel bad for that, but. Now you're going to tell me why I should check out Judy Wood. I'm sorry, man. I've addressed this stuff with 9/11. It probably is good info. And well, I have my opinions about Judy Wood and Fetzer. To me, it doesn't matter. I talked about this recently on the show, but I'll say it again. I really don't give a rat's ass, man. Honestly, I don't care. And I don't think anybody else out there should either. I don't give a rat's ass if it was thermite, nanothermite, laser beams, space beams, mini nukes. It makes no goddamn difference in the world to me how it happened, because I know that what they told us was an absolute lie. And I know that these people who are running this power structure were responsible for that. But that it took me a long time to figure it out myself. And you don't feel bad for falling into that. We all have. But it's a hamster wheel, man. It's a gerbil wheel. It's there to keep you stuck in the rat wheel, you know, spinning and spinning and running and never getting anywhere because it's a black hole. Because everybody, I don't care how much evidence somebody has, every single person's idea of it is still speculation. What we can prove is that these people have done this kind of thing many times, and they will do it many times more. And there is so much of this that they want you to get stuck on the 9/11 thing. That's why it was so nuts. That's why they did it the way they did it. Same thing with JFK. So that you would get stuck in, because that people, JFK wore off, and so they had to have a new one. Because for years, people got hung up on the JFK conspiracy before 9/11. See, I was awake before 9/11 and before the 9/11 truth movement, so I remember this. But before 9/11, dude, it was all about JFK. It's funny to me how many people weren't around back then or weren't into this stuff back then, don't remember that. But it used to be all about JFK. And that's exactly how that became. It became an endless rat wheel of speculation and possibilities and conspiracy theories and a tangled mess in a web. But at the end of the day, we weren't ever any closer to the truth. I learned more truth about the Kennedy assassination in the time in which I was making The Secret Right Volume 2 than I ever learned in almost 10 years of researching the Kennedy assassination on my own. Why? Because the information that I was looking at was not giving me the pertinent information that makes it important. Like, where do we start? I don't want to get into Kennedy right now, but I mean, you know, all the guys that he fired, all the guys from the CIA, all those guys, all his enemies, every single one of them, all Knights of Malta. We were never told that. Never told me why that was important. How come Oliver Stone or Jim Mars or any of the other guys out there never talked about that, never brought that up, never found that? It's all over the place. The chic, skinny Knights of Malta, look that up. This was some dirty, greasy, Guido, WAP, fucking mob, mafioso shit that they did with Kennedy, man. And if you don't get that element of it and you don't understand it, don't understand how these guys work, you're never going to wrap your mind around it. And that's what it's intended to do. And it's intended to get people hung up in it so they never see any of the other conspiracies that are going on. They never see any of the other deeper information. But Kennedy wore off, and they had to have a new one, and 9/11 will sustain them for quite some time because of the just the sheer trauma-based mind control of the whole event. So, you know, it's funny. Don't take me the wrong way. That's another problem I have whenever I have new listeners. You know, when I'm just flat, I'm just straight with people, and I shoot straight on the show. And when I do that, sometimes people get butt hurt. And you know, no offense to you, sir. I appreciate you trying to pass on some information to me. But I know all about the Judy Wood stuff. I know all about any of that, and I'm not interested in any of it. But every time I get a new listener, and I appreciate it, this has happened, I don't know how many times, like a lot, 20 or 30 times. The first thing out of the gates they want to do is pin me. Well, to be honest with you, it's happened a whole more than that the whole time I've been doing radio. But every time I get a new listener, sometimes they want to pin you in a corner on what you are. Well, what are you? Are you a no planer, man? Are you no planer? You know the no plane theory? You know, are you over here on Judy Wood's team, man? Are you over there? You're not over there with the plane huggers, are you? That's what they call people who believe was airplanes. They call them plane huggers. You're not over there with the plane huggers, are you, man? The thermite people. They always want to try to pin me in a corner. And the first film I ever made in 2007 was called 9/11 New World Rising. It was a 9/11 film. And I made that. I was originally going to make a film on secret societies, and I had all this 9/11 stuff, but I had never seen in 9/11 film, so I decided to make one. And it's funny because the things I show in that film, I show a lot of things that, you know, could indicate to somebody that I might believe in the no plane theory or something like that, or the space beam theory. Because what I tried to do with that film was to not put an opinion on it as far as what I thought it was. So I did a lot of slow-mo shots on the planes going in and the different little, you know, things that you see coming out, the flashes inside the building. Did a lot of zoom-ins and stuff because I wanted to make the point that, look, something's not right with this. Whether or not I know exactly what that is or you know exactly what that is, you know, is really irrelevant. But if you look at this with your eyes open, there's no way you can't look at some of the footage in 9/11 New World Rising and not question the official story. And that was my whole intent, my whole purpose. But, you know, I had people who said, you know, oh, man, you proved the controlled demolition theory. And I had people who said, oh, man, you proved the no plane theory. And I had people from both sides, you know, into that movie and complimenting me on that movie. And to me, that was mission accomplished. You know, because, you know, if you watch that movie and you think that it supports no plane theory, hey, then it does. You know, if it, for you, doesn't mean I intended it to be that way, but it's, you know, I try to do my best to just present the information as unbiased of a way as I possibly can. It was very hard doing that, making The Secret Right Volume 1 and 2, because you want to fly off and just be emotional and be like, blah, blah, blah. But it's better just to present the information and the facts as they stand to people and let them come to their own judgments, you know, one way or the other. This is from Matt. He says, hey, Josh, I had set today aside to go and shoot your video footage at Cahokia, but I incurred yet another problem that will cause a delay. I had told you that my original delay was waiting for a tripod. Well, the tripod turned out to be a total piece of shit, and I didn't open it until today. And the main necessity of the tripod was to do clean, sweeping shots, but this was so cheap that the joint wouldn't twist without a noticeable vibration caused by the friction. So today I've ordered, and now I'm waiting for a new Sony tripod. I must tell you, I'm slightly concerned about the cameras I have access to in terms of their quality and ability to do any type of motion shot. It might best to give you non-moving shots in 1080p and motion shots in 720p with my Mino HD flip cam with aspect ratio changing widening lens. You know what? You know, you can... honestly, I've looked at these Cahokia mounds now. And, well, first off, here's what I need you to find out, Matt, when you go there. I need you to find out how many of the mounds were destroyed and rebuilt. Because I have since found out that for a lot of years, and it kind of made me think about Rockwall, maybe, you know, kind of gave me hope. But there was housing divisions for years where the Cahokia mounds are. It's somebody bought out the housing division and they excavated it and reconstructed the mounds there, but I don't know how much of it is original, how much of it isn't. It may all be reconstructed. If it's all reconstructed, to be honest with you, I'm kind of less interested in it than I was before. But the question is whether or not Monk's Mound, which is one of the mounds in Cahokia, is the largest. It's actually the one, Monk's Mound at Cahokia, Illinois, is the... it's like the largest. It's bigger, has a bigger footprint than the Pyramid of Giza. It's massive. But it may have been rebuilt. I'm not for sure. But after looking at it, Matt, don't worry about the sweeping shots. You can just set that tripod up and get some nice, you know, shots of just, you know, set the tripod up, shoot for about 30 seconds or a minute. However long, you know, the more you give me to work with, the better. And you can just go around angle to angle to the different, you know, from side to side and shoot for a minute there, shoot for a minute on the other side. And I can edit all that together, make it look nice and cut together. So don't worry about that. Just do what you can do, man. And I'll take it. Just as long as the footage is stable and it's not wobbly and wonky, then I it's really good and usable for me. But when it's wobbling and stuff like that, it's very difficult. Man, we only have a few news stories here tonight. I wanted to mention this, though. I was talking about this earlier. There seems to be quite a lot of importance being placed on this solar eclipse coming up Sunday. And with the NATO summit going on this weekend, it has made me think that, you know, maybe they're planning something this weekend, a ritualistic type of event. But to give you an idea of this, here's a couple of stories. Scientists to watch historic Venus transit of the sun from Alaska. A NASA sun-watching spacecraft will have an unbeatable view of June's historic Venus transit, but some of the probe scientists are taking measures to get a great look for themselves here, too. NASA Solar Dynamic Observatory satellites will watch from space as Venus crosses the sun's face on June 5th, the last such Venus transit until December 21, 17. Wasn't somebody predicting something would happen on June 5th? I don't know. Not content to live vicariously through their spacecraft, some SDO scientists are headed to Alaska to watch the seven-hour event in its entirety. A historic event. So they're putting a lot of emphasis on this Venus transit coming up June 5th. And then this article says, from Live Science, says, Sunday solar eclipse visible from national parks. Yeah, because there was probably mounds there. They were probably aligned to, you know, different things. When the sun vanishes behind the moon for the first time over the United States in this century, what better place to enjoy the view than from one of the 154 national parks that stand in its path? Astronomy lovers in the United States will be treated to a partial disappearance of the sun behind the moon this Sunday, May 20th. Only the eastern seaboard will be totally exempt. Over the course of the solar eclipse, the sun won't vanish completely, but will remain as a ring around the moon for what is known as an annular eclipse. When the eclipse occurs, the moon will be near its most distant point from Earth, making it appear smaller in the sky and thus unable to block the entire sun, but it will be a stunning sight. Now listen to this. 33 national parks will see the full effect of the moon's interference. Now that's interesting, isn't it? Because again, you mean, why do you think a lot of these spots are national parks? They were spots because they were, you know, these were sacred spots for the ancient people that were here. It wasn't just, oh, let's put a national park here. No, it was there for a reason. So coincidentally, 33 out of 154 national parks where this solar eclipse ring of fire is going to be visible from, and that's what's interesting even about it, it's called the ring of fire. 33, the ring of fire. I mean, this is interesting. Well, NATO summit's going on this weekend. 33 national parks will see the full effect of the moon's interference. That just, you can't tell me that's a coincidence. 33 national parks are able to see the full effect of this ring of fire eclipse. That's really unbelievable. Many Western parks will be offering an array of events for their guests, ranging from placing telescopes out for viewing up to a full-scale astronomy festival. Man, if I had that freaking telescope I have on my wish list, man, hook that bitch up to my computer, my camera, get some footage of that, be rad. So, yeah, as I was saying, best be paying attention this weekend. Man builds Tesla gun that can shoot 20,000 volts of electricity. Add this to the increasing number of unusual weapons straight out of a sci-fi movie and repurposed Nerf gun equipped with a Tesla coil that can shoot up to 20,000 volts of electricity. This electrifying gun created by Rob Flickinger was inspired by the fictional Tesla gun from the steampunk graphic novel The Five Fists of Science. Oh, God, steampunk. Steampunk is what happens when goths find the color brown. Indeed. Quote me on that. Steampunk is what happens when goths find the color brown. No, it's cool, whatever. I don't really care. I don't really have that much of a hatred for it, but it is kind of annoying. It just, I don't know. I just see the people that are into it, and I swear to God, everybody I see that I've ever seen that is into steampunk is like a recovering goth. I used to be depressed, and I used to cut myself. But now I dress steampunk and go to steampunk cons, and because I'm so, well, I'm not really depressed anymore, but, Rush, one of my favorite bands, they're all into that right now. Actually, the last tour I saw them on, 2010, Time Machine Tour, Neil Peart had a steampunk drum set, and, Geddy Lee had this thing that shot sausages out behind him, and Alex Lifeson had these amps that were like giant jukeboxes. It's pretty rad, and they actually have a new album coming out this year, actually next month, Clockwork Angels. And they're going to have a steampunk graphic novel that goes along with it. It's going to be their first concept album in years, and it's going to be, I guess, somehow related to the steampunk thing. But, yeah, that's what happens when Gosk find Brown. I mean, that's really... Tesla coil gun, though. I'm down with that. I'll take one, please. Thank you. Police have warned motorists to be cautious while being pulled over on the highway after two people were killed by someone suspected to be posing as law enforcement late at night. We urge everyone to be cautious while driving, especially at night, the Tate County Sheriff's Office posted on their Facebook page. If someone attempts to pull you over with flashing lights and you feel unsure of stopping, don't pull over. Use your cell phone and dial 911, and if it's a real officer, then the dispatcher will confirm it for you. And if it's not a real officer, they will send help for you. Oh, bullshit. Oh, really? I mean, I don't know. I might take my chances with the murderer. I'm not playing. I'm not even trying to be funny here. I think I'd take my chances with the murderer. Because if it's not the murderer and your ass don't stop, they are going to put a fucking beat down on your ass when you get out of the fucking car. That's what they do when you evade arrest. They beat the fuck out of you. No ifs, ands, or buts. No gonna let you slide this time. If you evade arrest, the first thing they do when they pull you out of your car is they beat the fuck out of you. Oh, sorry, thought you were a murderer. Just haul ass. No. I'd take my chances with the murderer. Because, if you happen to have your dog in the car, they'll shoot your dog. At least the murderer, yeah, he might, He might try to kill you, but he probably won't kill your dog. I had talked about when the Junior Seau thing happened, the football player who died recently, all the fishy circumstances, the different stories they had. First, they said the housekeeper found him, then they said the girlfriend found him. There was just a lot of conflicting stories. And, somebody was had sent me an email saying that the reason this was is because of this litigation going on with different football players against the NFL, and yeah, it very well could be that they're snuffing these guys out, but it just doesn't look good when his Junior Seau's home was burglarized just days after his death. Now the media is portraying this as this was just some random. How dare somebody break into somebody's house after a dead man died? And that's the way they're portraying this in these articles, but I don't buy that for a second. It just sounds like prepackaged writing when you read it. There are people in or around the town of Oceanside, California, who just got an express trip to the place where the red guy with the horns and pitchfork does his business. There are few things more disgusting than a robbery that affects the family of a man who just died. And see, this sound they're making out, I don't buy this for a second. He knew something. And he had something. This was an execution. Somebody broke into the house to either get rid of evidence or get something that he had. Somebody murdered this guy. He didn't just kill himself. And it's going to be interesting to see how this whole concussion thing plays out. That's it, man. I don't have any other news tonight. I almost didn't do a show. It was almost pointless here tonight. But, well, hell, we got almost a whole hour out of the first hour tonight. So we're going to take a break, come back, and get into our new series of reading that we started tonight. Looking forward to getting back into this because that's kind of where my head is at right now. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. It's TheGlobalReality.com. We're going to take a break, come back, and get into more. Stay with us.
uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
Is it not? Check, check, check. Are we here? Are we rolling? What's going on here? You guys hear me? I wonder if the archive got hosed. No, it says it's still rolling. It says it's still rolling like it's supposed to. 10, yeah. Huh. I was just sitting there rolling on with the show, man. I didn't even know anything was wrong, huh? Well, the archive still says it's gravy. I don't see that anything's changed on the archive. We'll just have some blank space in there, but I guess I'll go with it. Huh, all right. Well, let's pretend like we just came back from the commercial break. How about that? And then if somebody wants to edit this later or something for YouTube, they can do that. Okay, let's pretend none of that. And sorry about that. I don't know what the hell happened. It was just said it was couldn't communicate with the server. That's when I looked down and saw that, and I looked down the chat room. But the archive still says it's been rolling okay. So, all right, here we go. Back here with you on the Global Reality, right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. In this segment of the broadcast tonight, we're going to be continuing our series of reading The Lost Worlds of Ancient America. And we left off last night talking about the Hemet Maze Stone. And we're going to be picking it back up and talking about that here tonight in our continued series of reading that we started last night. We had an email from Rick in San Diego tonight, actually, about this Hemet Stone. Apparently, I guess that's near San Diego. He says, "Hi, Josh, here you go. The rock in Hemet you were talking about last night." Oh, YouTube video. Sweet. Thanks, dude. I'll be planning a trip there as soon as I can get a friend to drive me. Thank you for sharing this with us. Finally, something near enough for me to travel to. All the best, Rick. Yeah, I... And you're not the only one, Rick. I've been getting emails from people in California. Hey, what about us? Don't forget about us. We want to go shoot stuff, too. What about us out here on the West Coast? And, you know, the more and more I'm finding with this research is, you know, I mean, if you've got something ancient in your area, go film it. I mean, it's all relevant. It all ties in, that's for sure. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. That's TheGlobalReality.com, and there you'll find all things pertaining to my work. We have a chip-in banner for the new film that I'm working on, The Lost Secrets of Ancient America, Volume 1, and we got to get that met by the end of the month to be able to stay on target to get the film out. So please help us out if you can. We also have a P.O. box if you absolutely can't use PayPal, and, of course, our Amazon wish list there where you can get things that we need for the film. Outstanding art as the Hemet petroglyph may be, it is neither the only one nor the largest, though perhaps the most finely executed of its kind in Southern California. There are several other stone mazes in the immediate vicinity. Something similar in nearby Ramona was accidentally found by hikers in 1977 after heavy rains exposed the design. They took it to the San Jacinto Town Hall, where it was displayed until politicians, ignorant of what else to do with the discovery, presented it to gracious, if perplexed, tribal leaders of the neighboring Sabota Indians, who continued to preserve the maze as the heirloom of a distant past of which they know nothing. I love that. I mean, they, you know, oh, well, it's got to be Indian. Take it to them damn Indians and tell them it's theirs. And they take the Indians are like, oh, well, we know nothing of this. You know? So far, about 50 maze stones have been identified throughout Orange, Riverside, Imperial, and San Diego counties. At least 14 examples of labyrinthine rock art are known in the remote area of Palm Springs. Contributing to their mystery, all of them have been found within 150 miles of each other, and virtually every one is rectangular, although varying in size from 4 inches to several feet in diameter. They are invariably located on mountainsides, remarkably alike in their boulder-dotted settings. Here, too, Hopi myth seems to fit the evidence, because the flood story recounts that as the waters rose to cover the ancestral island, its residents climbed mountainsides to escape drowning. The largest and most intricate design occurs 10 miles north of Hemet. As an example of the Dark Age mentality abroad in our land, the magnificent 4-foot-square relic was partially obliterated by 4 shotgun blasts in the early 1960s. But enough of it survived to yield faint traces of red, mineral-based paint that originally filled the glyph. Subsequent investigation of other maze carvings showed they likewise bore hints in varying degrees of red paint, an important discovery that may assist further in their dating their creation, at least relative to each other. The less obvious the presence of red paint, the older the petroglyph. The Hemet stone evidences no indication of red, so it was either never painted or is the oldest maze, its paint having been weathered away over time. In the Hopi crown dance, the flood is recounted by a chief speaker who begins, "I remember the old red land, the birthplace of his ancestors, before it went under the waves." Every Indian tribe recounted its own version of a global inundation and the flight of ancestral survivors from the east over the Atlantic Ocean. Remarkably, this foundation myth was not imported, along with the proselytizing efforts of 16th through 19th century Christian missionaries, but predated their arrival by unknown generations. There you go. That's what I was pointing out to Michael in the chat room last night. He was talking about going to these Hopewell mounds in Michigan, and he didn't even know he had seen them, because they just look like mounds of mumps of dirt in the river. And I said, well, yeah, you know, think about it. After the last flood is when the rivers and things like that that we know of were formed. And these things are built to withstand floods. So that's why, I mean, because there's some near Mobile, Alabama, that are in the middle of a fucking island in the middle of a swamp. Nobody built that in the middle of the swamp. That swamp wasn't there when that was built. And that's why we know that these things are so much older than the natives, even, that we're told built these things. It's so awesome to read a book like this on air, I got to tell you, that just, you know, reinforces and backs up all the research I found on my own. That's really refreshing. Accordingly, Native American recollection of the cataclysm did not originate in the biblical Genesis, although both share some details. Interestingly, as the swastika signified North American Hopi predecessor migration from the catastrophe, the hooked cross was likewise the symbol of pre-Columbian Mexico Calahuque, the Aztec goddess of the deluge. Her myth told how she changed its victims into fish. The same transformation recounted by flood myths of the Babylonians and American Lakota Sioux. Our Lady of the Turquoise Skirt, a reference to the sea, was commemorated during an annual ceremony in which priests collected reeds, dried them out, and then placed them inside her shrine. As writing utensils, the reeds symbolized wisdom for her lost overseas homeland, the place of reeds. It was renowned as Aslan. What? See, that's what I found a lot of indicators of towards the rock wall, that it was Aslan. Oh, my goodness. Phonetic and mythic resemblances to the Greek Atlantis are inescapable. Indeed, temple art represented the turquoise woman seated on a throne surrounded by men and women drowning in a huge whirlpool. Perhaps California's formerly red mazes were meant to preserve that same tradition as ceremonial markers for ritual pilgrimages in imitation of a great migration from some natural disaster undertaken by its survivors. And that is very, 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 very interesting. That they, you know, they were turned into fish. And right after we were talking about last night, this DNA evidence, and you know, that proves who really were the ancestors of what we know as Native Americans. It's very interesting that that DNA evidence says that happened 50,000 years ago. And all the text and everything, and Manly P. Hall says that the fall of Atlantis was 50,000 years ago. And right at that same time is when you had, who I always called him Onas, but I wasn't saying that right, Oannes, who was another representation. Well, Manly P. also says that 50,000 years ago at the fall of Atlantis was when the Atlantean priests, like Thoth, went around and started giving culture and technology and things like that to the savages of different lands. And I heard that in a Manly P. Hall lecture from I don't know how many years ago, and here I have this DNA evidence from just a couple of years ago, well past since Manly P. Hall has been dead, that here's that 50,000 figure again. I mean, this is blowing me away. I have to disagree with you, Michael D. in the chat room, 100%. I have to disagree with you. I disagree. Rockwall is not just the tip of the iceberg in North America. You show me another site in the United States of America that you can date 100% to 55 billion years. The paleomagnetic survey from Dr. Wolf Goss at the University of Texas indicates that the wall is 55 million years old at least. I don't know of any other sites. Yes, there have been some similar sites that Rockwall found, but none that have dated to 55 million years. We're talking about a pre-human, but that's the thing that people can't wrap their minds around about this research, because I'm getting into two different things here. We're talking about such an expanse of time that, you know, the Rockwall was ancient by the time humans slimed their way out of the muck. Chapter 2. Ancient Roman Figurine in New Jersey Waters by Wayne May and Roman Coins Found in Kentucky by Lee Pennington. Discovery in 1990 of a freighter that sank during the early years of Imperial Rome off the Mediterranean coast of South France took archaeologists by surprise. Their hereto low opinion of Roman seamanship was overturned by the well-preserved vessel's rugged construction and sophisticated design. With such a ship, sailors of Caesar's time could have successfully completed transatlantic voyages to America. That they actually did so is attested by some of their surviving artifacts found from New Jersey to the Middle West. On April 15, 2003, a scuba diver searched the seafloor off New Jersey for shark fossils known to be strewn in the sands near Red River Bank, or near River Red Bank. In fact, it had been known earlier as Shark River, for an abundance of the animals found in the area, some 10 miles south of Sandy Hook. But what Nelson Jekus discovered was more than a common fossil. Approximately 15 feet beneath the surface in limited visibility, the 55-year-old Barnesville resident fetched a small, strange object from the ocean bottom. Returning it with it to the dry land, he saw that the small item was a 4-inch-long figurine, weighing about 18 ounces and carved from a reddish stone of some kind. Although severely eroded through apparently long exposure to underwater conditions, the object still clearly represented a woman atop a man engaged in sexual intercourse. Mr. Jekus took his find for professional appraisal to New York's Arte Primitivo auction house, where expert examiners specialize in classifying, buying, and selling ancient artifact collections. Divulging nothing about the circumstances concerning its discovery, He showed the figurine to the auction house's gallery curator. Mr. Howard Rose easily identified the Shark River artifact as a common fertility image made in Roman Egypt during the early 3rd century AD. Jekus believes it probably belonged to an Egypto-Roman sailor who reached the New Jersey shore about 1,800 years ago. The graphic figurine is important physical evidence for ancient Old World contact in North America, supporting related discoveries along the eastern shores of our continent. Away from the location where Jekus made his discovery, a man combing the Massachusetts coast with a metal detector near Beverly found 8 Roman coins within a single square yard of the beach. The relatively well-preserved coins were all minted during the 4th century AD and identified by numismatologists as belonging to the reigns of Emperor Constantinus II, Valentinus I, Valens, and Gratianus. According to Dr. Barry Fell, as there were 58 emperors of Rome who issued some 3,000 kinds of coins commonly found in Europe, the chances of a single find site yielding coins of consecutive rulers spanning only 4 decades can be estimated as roughly 1 in 100,000. Thus, the coins are not being found as a result of accidental losses by collectors, but are strongly correlated with some factor linked to a short span of time of 337 to 383 AD and linked also to a single, very restricted find site. The only reasonable explanation is that these coins are coming from the money chest of a merchant ship carrying current coin in use around 375 AD. Over the past 1,600 years, the coins have gradually drifted inshore on the bottom current and are now being thrown up by waves in heavy weather. Roman coins found in Kentucky. Lightning has struck once again for a Charlestown, Indiana man. The chances are rather slim, one might think, of anyone finding a single hoard of Roman coins. The chances of finding 2 sets might be considered off the charts, yet that's exactly what happened to David Wells. As reported in Ancient American Magazine in June 2009, Wells, using a metal detector, found 8 Roman coins along the Ohio River near Louisville, Kentucky, in the early part of 2009. Wells found a second hoard of coins containing an additional 11 coins, June 14, 2009, a few miles east from where Wells found the first set. My brother Don and I were exploring along the riverbank about a mile from beyond Bethlehem, a small Indiana town 31 miles east of Louisville. Don went up the river and I started exploring downstream using my metal detector. Before we went to lunch, I found 3 coins. After lunch, I decided to go back to the same spot and found 8 more. Wells said the coins were about 4 to 6 inches deep in the sandy soil, located in a serpentine line stretching about 30 feet along the bank parallel with the river. They looked just like they had been washed up there by a wave or something. An immediate response might be that no one is ever going to find 2 hoards of Roman coins, and a report of such thing is suspicious. Although rare, such a thing does happen. As stated by the British Broadcasting Corporation on October 30, 2008, in Ancients, Shipwrecks, and Treasure, a local metal detector enthusiast in Sully Vale of Glamorgan, Wales, found not 1 but 2 very large hoards of Roman coins on successive days. One hoard contained 2,366 coins. The other contained 3,547 coins. The BBC also reported that a similar find was uncovered in the same area during 1899. The Wells find does not include the first Roman coins found along the Ohio River in the Falls of the Ohio area. During 1963, when the Sherman-Minton Bridge was being built across the river between Louisville, Kentucky, and New Albany, Indiana, an engineer digging out a pier for the span found some 20 Roman coins about 3 feet beneath the surface. 2 of the coins were given to another engineer who has since died. The widow of the engineer who received the 2 coins donated them to the Falls of the Ohio Interpretive Center, where they remain. The engineer who originally found the bridge coins moved out of town, and his whereabouts, as well as the coins he took with him, are unknown. The two wells discoveries containing 19 Roman coins, 8 in the first hoard and 11 in the second, may be just part of the picture. Another Roman coin was reportedly found about 25 years ago along the river just west of Louisville at Corydon, Indiana. Accordingly, more than 70 Roman coins have been found in the immediate vicinity. Many dozens of Roman coins, such as this 2009 Kentucky find, have been found from New England to the Midwest. Considered by many mainstream archaeologists to be the definitive article on pre-Columbian coins found in America, is nearly a 30-year-old piece by Jeremiah Epstein. Pre-Columbian Old World Coins in America, an examination of the evidence in the February 1980 issue of Current Anthropology magazine. Epstein discussed 40 different coins found in North America between 1533 and 1977, dismissing them all as no evidence of prehistoric contact, instead attributing them to losses by modern-day collectors, or in some cases, deliberate fraud. So between 1533 and 1977, they found all of these coins, and yet we're supposed to believe that somebody just planted it there? I mean, anybody that thinks that's got to be a complete idiot. They're not going to find these over the span of 1533 to 1977. Somebody's been planting those coins that long? For centuries, somebody's been planting coins. I don't buy that for a second. You got to be an idiot to believe that. Come on. But that's what this, official scientist is saying here. He writes, insofar as the coins are concerned, no case can be made for pre-Columbian contact between America and the Mediterranean. Epstein points out that of this list of 40 coins, 31 of them were made during the 20th century. Following World War II, he suggests the imbalance of coins finds up to the 20th century, and those found afterward, especially following the year, resulted from Americans traveling to Europe and purchasing the coins. This coincides, he stated, with a time when Americans, whether as inductees or as tourists, traveled to Europe in great numbers, and it seems reasonable to suppose that many of the coins found since 1914 had been lost by Americans who brought them back from Europe. Okay. But it's just as reasonable to suppose the increase in coin finds is the direct result of the invention of the metal detector. Gerhard Fischer applied for and was granted the first patent for such a device in 1937. Since then, literally millions of enthusiasts are out using metal detectors daily, and one would expect the discovery of lost coins to increase exponentially, just as in this case, interestingly, of the 40 coins Epstein describes, 32 of them are Roman. The other 8 are identified as Phoenician, Greek, and Hebrew. Here we go. Another interesting thing that Epstein's article shows is that exactly half of the 40 coins under discussion were minted during the 2nd and 3rd centuries AD. Now, that's another coincidence. You can't just say that these were all, these were just dropped by people, and people planted these for 500 years along the riverbanks. How could they go through the trouble of putting coins that were only minted during the 2nd and 3rd centuries over the course of 500 years? That's just retarded. Likewise, the majority of coins in the two David Wells collections fall into this time period. The same date perimeters bracket the 10 coins in the Kingsman collection found along the Wisconsin River during the 1970s, as reported by Professor James P. Schertz. The same holds true for 12 coins found by Michael Wayne Griffith in a cave shelter at Breathitt County, Kentucky. Many of the Roman coins found in the United States are easily identifiable regarding the century of their manufacture by their depiction of a solar crown called a radiate. Radiate coins were only minted between 215 and 295 AD. A strong supporter of Epstein's conclusions is Professor Miguel Rivera Dorado, Departamento de Antropología de America in Madrid, Spain. He's probably a fucking Jesuit anyway, or Knights of Malta. Commenting on Epstein's conclusion that none of the pre-Columbian coins found in America are legitimate, Riviera says a relatively great number of ancient coins have been found, while in contrast, there was a lack of amphorae, votive offerings, candlesticks, swords, and belt buckles. None of these latter articles can be easily acquired on a tourist trip. There are a few collectors of them, and they do not get lost easily because of their form and value. Dorado's mention of Roman swords, however, may be premature. In 1999, Buddy Lemon of Redland, Kentucky, dug up a sword afterward possibly identified as a 2nd century Roman artifact. Lemon found the weapon using his metal detector along a bank near the mouth of the Tennessee River, which empties into the Ohio River. Members of the Ancient Kentucky Historical Association in Louisville interviewed Lemon and photographed his find. I was just below Kentucky Dam when my metal detector went off. I started digging with a shovel and found it about 2 feet down. The late Michael Paul Henson reported for Lost Treasure magazine in 1993 that Lemon's discovery was identical to a specimen picked up earlier near Cincinnati, Ohio. Likewise, along the Ohio River, two more Roman swords have been retrieved from the Mississippi River at St. Paul, Minnesota. And 532 miles down its banks southward to St. Louis, Missouri, with yet another example found near Nashville, Tennessee on the Cumberland, which empties into the Ohio River. Described as Henson as an intricately engraved Roman sword of about 100 A.D., the same period he inscribed to the weapon found by Lemon, the St. Paul blade particularly underscores the Fred Kingman coin collection's prehistoric authenticity, because both discoveries occurred in general proximity to each other. The Cincinnati, St. Louis, and Nashville swords were recovered from 4 feet beneath the surface of the ground, suggesting they were all buried at the same time and could not, therefore, have been accidentally deposited in modern times somehow or hoaxed. Ancient visitors traveling up the Mississippi River would likely explore other major connecting waterways in touch with the Ohio and Wisconsin rivers off the Mississippi, Cumberland, and the Tennessee River, all places where Roman coins or Roman swords have been discovered. Well, yeah, they found the Back Creek inscription not far from the Tennessee River. Phoenician carving that says for Judea. Epstein was apparently not aware of the Sherman Mint and Bridge coins, nor the Fred Kingman coins of the 1970s, although he found previous to Epstein's article, these coins evidently were not reported in the literature until after the publication of his article in 1980. Despite the great number of Roman coins found in North America, many more perhaps not even have ever gotten reported. As a late Norman Totten professor of history at Bentley College and an authority on pre-Columbian coins pointed out in commenting on Epstein's report, clear distinctions need to be made between finds and published reports of finds. Most coins, wherever found, are never officially reported, much less published. The same is true of other kinds of ancient artifacts discovered outside archaeological excavations. A revealing picture emerges when all the locations of Roman coins reportedly found in our country are plotted on a map of North America. It shows that virtually all of them were discovered at or near waterways, mostly along the Mississippi and Ohio rivers. Together with their watersheds, 6 related finds took place on the eastern seaboard in 1950 on Plum Island, Massachusetts, circa 1965 at Long Island Sound, Connecticut, around 1970 at Princeton, New Jersey, about 1960 in Queen Anne's County, Maryland, 1956 in Gloucester County, Virginia, and circa 1970 on St. Simon's Island, Georgia. 2 other Roman coins were found in the Gulf of Mexico area around 1970 at Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and at about 1970 on St. Joseph Island, Texas. No such coins are reported to have been found west of the Rocky Mountains. That fact alone weakens Epstein's argument assigning the lost coins to careless collectors. These enthusiasts reside, in fact, on both sides of the continental divide. Individually, the ancient coins found in North America may be a little more than anomalous curiosities, but we see in the aggregate they form a recognizable pattern left by visitors from Imperial Rome to those areas of our continent where they passed into prehistory. And I was just mentioning the Back Creek inscription, the Back Creek stone, And that's where we'll be picking up next time on the next show. Chapter 3, Tennessee's Ancient Hebrew Inscription. That is the Bat Creek Inscription. So we'll be getting into that. And that's something I've already been looking into. And that's something I'm going to try to go actually go get footage of for the new film. But we got to meet our budget goal for that. So please come forward and help us out. I'm asking anybody out there, you know, old donators, new donators, anybody that can help us out. We got to pay the stream bill this week, too. Please support our work if you can. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. And help us get down on the get down, man. We got work to do. We got to get it done. And we can't do it without your support. And we thank each and every one of you out there for your continued support of this broadcast and of my work and for all your good emails and love and energy. Appreciate each and every one of you out there so much. My name is Josh Reeves. We will see you tomorrow on the broadcast. You guys have yourselves a nice one. Take care.